The Chumash Bereishis is basically about the Aves, about the parents, then the Chumash Shmeis and the further later Chumashim are all about the children. In the parents, there were events that happened in kind of a capsulated form, in brief form. For example, Avraham went down to Egypt for a while and came back up with great wealth, which is an encapsulated form of the Golos Mitzrayim that later happened with the children, with the Bnei Yisrael. So the Chumash of Shmeis begins with Eile Shmeis Bnei Yisrael, because from now on, we're going to be dealing with the children of the Aves, and how they experienced and completed and lived out that which the parents, in symbolic form and in encapsulated form, began in the Chumash of Bereishis. So the Rebbe says that it's like Bina elaborating on Chochmah, or like Teira Shebal Peh, it's like the Gemara elaborating on the Teira Shebiksav, where the written Torah is very brief and concise, and the Teira Shebal Peh, the Gemara, elaborates and analyzes and explains and gives the details to what the Torah says. In a sicha, the first sicha on Shmeis, in Chelek Vav, volume 6 of Likutei Sichas, the Rebbe speaks about the Rashi that explains the reason for the counting and for the mentioning of the names of the Shvatim who came down to Egypt. Since they were already counted and mentioned in Vayigash, why is it necessary to repeat again? And one of the things that Rashi says is Shenimshalu L'Kechavim, that Jews are compared to the stars, and just as God counts the stars and calls each of them by their name, he treats the Jews the same way that he counts them and he calls them by name, both when they're coming out and when they're being gathered back in the stars. And the same is true also with the Jews. When the generation came down to Egypt, they were counted, and then when that generation ended, by the end of the lifespan of the Shvatim, they were counted again. And their names were mentioned, because by counting and by mentioning names, you express affection. The Rebbe's question is, since counting expresses affection, and referring to something by name expresses affection, why do we need both? And here's the Rebbe's explanation. When you count something, when you give something a number, and when you call something by name, you're expressing different and almost opposite forms of affection. By numbering something, giving something a number, you're expressing that aspect of this particular item in which all of the counted items are equal. When you have a set of 10 things, for example, and each one is counted as one, then they are all equal in their significance. Each one is one-tenth, one digit of that total number. And so you're emphasizing the significance that they all share in common, something that they all have that makes them equal. Each one of them is one, not more and not less than one. On the other hand, when you refer to something by its name, here you're expressing that which makes each of them different and separate from the others, because everyone has a different and separate name. And this is what Rashi is saying when he says that Jews are compared to stars, because in the stars we see these two things. One hand, there is that which all stars have in common. A star is a star, not more and not less. But each of them is significant, and therefore each of them has a number. They're not referred to by groups or by pounds, but by individual number. But each individual star is similar in that they're all stars. And then number two, each star has a unique and individual identity that makes it separate from all other stars. And this is what Rashi means, that we are compared to the stars, because in Jews also we find these two things. First, there is that which is precious about every Jew, because we are all a part of God, Chelek Elokam Mimal Mamash. We are all the children of Yaakov. We are all God's children. We have one Father. And then, this we all have in common. And then there is that quality that makes the individual Jew precious and special as an individual, not as a part of the group. And this is expressed in the two forms of affection, counting and naming, as we'll soon see. The inner meaning of these things is, according to Hasidus, that when God counted the Jewish people with their names, he was expressing a very special and unique affection that doesn't really exist even by the stars. And this is as follows. Counting means that the greatest in the group and the smallest in the group become united in that they are all one member of the group, which means that in spite of the differences between them, there is a great overreaching virtue, something that is greater even than the virtues of the individual parts, and in that they are all equal, and to express that is a form of affection. So that with Jewish neshamas, for example, there are great neshamas, high neshamas, and there are simple neshamas, yet we say, as the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, Kulon masima is v'av echad l'kulona. We have to have avas Yisrael to every Jew equally, because there is that which is the great equalizer for all neshamas, and that is, we are all similar and we have one Father. So we are united in that fact, and the virtue of having this Father and all being similar, this is referring not to some detail of the neshama, but to the essence of the neshama. In the essence, if we trace ourselves back to our source, to the rock from which we are taken, there we are all equal. And what is that part of the neshama? It's the part of the neshama that transcends the particular individual character and virtue. So by counting, we're actually referring to that part of the neshama that is the essence of the neshama that transcends our differences. And that's why we can count each person as one, not more and not less, because in this we are all equal. So when we come to the essence of the neshama, there our differences fall away and we are all equal. Now, when you mention name, when you refer to someone by name, this too refers to the essence of the neshama, greater and higher than the particular talents of the neshama. How do we see this? We see that when you give a person a name, you use that name to address the person all the days of his life. Even though in the course of his life, he goes through major changes from childhood to adulthood to his older years, and yet through it all, the same name is used and is addressed and he responds to that same name throughout all the changes, which suggests that the name refers to that which is unchanging in the person. When you call someone by his name, you're addressing that part of him that will never change, that is always the same. So we see that we are referring to an essential condition in the person rather than a particular, which of course will change in the course of time. But since it isn't the essence of the neshama that needs to be fixed, the aveda, the service, is not with the essence of the neshama, but rather through its expressions and through its particular individual virtues. So it is necessary to bring the strength and the power of this unchanging and transcending essence of the neshama, to bring that power into the individual faculties and into the individual behavior of everyday life, that which is the revealed part of the neshama, so that we can serve God properly. So how does this happen? The essence of the neshama has to be called forth and revealed into everyday life, and that's why God counts the Jews and calls them by name, as Rashi says, Lohidiya Chibosan, to make known the affection that God has for the Jew. So it's not enough that there is an affection. It's not enough that God appreciates the essence of the neshama. He has to call it forth, make it known, Lohidiya Chibosan, to reveal this affection, or to reveal that part of the neshama which, for which God has the affection. And how is this done? By counting and by referring to each by name. We find, for example, in the love of children, the love of parents to children, which, by the way, devolves from the love that God has for us, which is why an only child is loved in a special way, more than if there are other children, because to God, the Jewish people is an only child. And therefore it is in our nature that an only child is loved more, or in a special way, different from a child that has siblings. So this love that parents have for children, which is an expression of God's love for us, is expressed in many different ways. You can express the affection, parents can express their affection, by calling them by name, and by endearing the name, by adding an endearment at the end of the name, and so on. And this form of affection is much greater than the other forms of affection, such as giving a present, speaking lovingly, or embracing or kissing. Because the giving of a gift, for example, speaking word lovingly, will change according to the age and maturity of the child. It must change. If, for example, you give a child a gift that is inappropriate for their age, you give a grown child a gift that is appropriate for a small child, for a young child, then that gift will not express affection. It can, in fact, be the opposite of affection. And the same in reverse, if you give a small child a gift that is appropriate for a grown child, that also does not express affection. So we see that a gift has to change according to the level and according to the maturity of the child, which tells us that a gift does not address the essence of a child, doesn't address the essence of a person. And because it is not the essence, it needs to keep adjusting and changing according to the particular level or particular condition in which the child is at a given time. And of course the same is true also with affectionate talk, expressing love verbally. When does that work? Only when the child is old enough to appreciate, understand what is being said. And since the loving conversation and the gift, which are the tools through which the expression is being revealed, the affection is being revealed, since they have to adjust to the age and to the maturity of the child, we see that this is not the essence that we're talking to. We're talking to the intelligence of the child, we're talking to the emotions of the child, but not to the essence. Even the love expressed through embracing and kissing also has its limitations. For example, you can only embrace and kiss a child when the child is in close proximity. But over a distance, that isn't possible at all. So we see again that the essence of the child is not being addressed, but rather some finite physical part that has to be present in the room in order to be embraced, in order to be kissed. Only then does that affection get expressed. But from a distance, it can't be expressed. And what's more, the expression of affection that comes through a kiss is only appropriate when the child is aware that he's being kissed, not when he's asleep. And so again, this is not reaching or not touching the essence of the person. It's touching only the conscious part of the person. Whereas mentioning someone by name, referring to a person by name, here we see that this is unlimited. It has no restrictions. It doesn't change from childhood to adulthood. It doesn't have to be in the same room where the person is, where the object of the affection is, the person who is being loved. But even from a distance, when you mention someone by name, you are expressing affection. And that's because the name addresses the essence of the person. And so the affection also is for the essence and not for the particular details. Now we might say that counting, where the individuals who are being counted are not separated from each other, rather all of them contain the same significance. They each have one, the significance of one. They are each one member of the group. Whereas with the name, each one is separate, and the name distinguishes one from the other. And the fact that the name is unchanging, constant, is only within the person himself, that he will always have the same name regardless of the changes that life will bring. But it does separate him from everybody else. So from this we see that these two forms of affection, counting and naming, although they both refer to the essence of the neshama, they are referring to different times in the neshama. The counting, where all neshamas are equal, are the same, that's the neshama as it is in heaven, before it comes down in a body. Whereas the counting, the naming, when you give the neshama a name, that's referring to the neshama, the essence of the neshama, but as the essence of the neshama has already come down into a body. And that's why it now has a name, because we know that in heaven, souls don't have names. A name comes into existence only when a child is born and then is given a name. And this is the meaning of the fact that God counted the Jews by their names, not as with the stars, where God expresses affection for the stars in two ways, by counting them and by referring to them by name. Here, there was a unique affection in that he counted them by their name, not two separate forms of affection, but combining them together, counting them by name. And what this means is this. We already said the counting refers to the neshama as it is in heaven, and the naming refers to the neshama as it is on earth, as it comes into a body. So the meaning here is that by counting with the name, we are bringing that part of the neshama that is higher than the body, that essence of the neshama as it remains in heaven, we're bringing that into effect and into expression in the part of the neshama that is in the body. And this is why this counting takes place in the Bnei Yisrael Haboyim Mitzrayimah, that this is necessary to count by name just before the Jews come down into Egypt, and this time into the Golos of Mitzrayim, not like when Yaakov came down with his children, when they had the best 18 years, 17 years of Yaakov's life. But here the Golos of Mitzrayim began. So they are Boyim Mitzrayimah, they are coming into the Golos of Mitzrayim. Here it is necessary that the essence of the neshama be revealed in the part of the neshama that is in the body that is subjected to the Golos, to the condition of Golos. So that even in Mitzrayim, even in a position, in a condition of Golos, the neshama should illuminate even the details of a person's life, that the number, meaning the essence of the neshama, should be felt in the name, meaning the details and the parts of the personality and the behavior of the person should be permeated with the essence of the neshama. Now this is done twice, as it says about the stars, that God counts them when they come out, and he counts them when he gathers them back in, which means the beginning of life and the end of life. And this works in two directions, the Rebbe says. On the one hand, the essence of the neshama, the counting, affects the name of the neshama, the part of the neshama that is in the body. So that the details of a person's life, the details of a person's personality, is elevated and liberated from being fixed in a particular form and a particular style where the person has no choice but to be a certain way. The essence of the neshama illuminates that part of the personality and frees it to be what it needs to be, what it ought to be. So the part of the neshama that is in the body benefits greatly from the essence of the neshama that is above the body, beyond the body. But then at the end of life, it reverses, where the part of the neshama that was in the body now benefits the part of the neshama that was not. Because through the part of the neshama that was in the body, that served God through the mitzvahs that only a body can do, only the neshama in the body can do, then the virtues and the merit that was accumulated by the neshama in the body benefits the essence of the neshama, that the essence of the neshama is enriched through the performance of mitzvahs that is possible only in the body. In a different sicha on Shemais, the Rebbe says that in this parsha, in the parsha of Shemais, that deals with coming down to Mitzrayim and eventually coming out of Mitzrayim, we find a story about Lashon Hara. And that is where, after Moshe had killed the Egyptian who was hitting a Jew, the next day he came out and he found two Jews arguing, Dosan Va'aviram, and one raised his hand against the other, and Moshe said, Rasha Lomo Sakereyecha. Why are you're wicked one, why are you hitting your friend? And then they turned to him and they said, are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian? And so the Torah says, Vayira Moshe. Moshe was frightened, Vayemar, and he said, Ochein Noida Hadava. Now I see that the matter is known. So the simple meaning is, Moshe was frightened because these people knew or had seen him kill the Egyptian, and that it would now be known, it would now be told, and his life would be in danger. But Rashi says that according to the Medrash, there's another meaning here. What was Moshe afraid of? And what is it that now was known? So Rashi says that Moshe was concerned because he saw that there is Lashon Hara among Jews. And he said, now I am not so sure that the Jews are deserving of the Geula, of being redeemed from Egypt. And what is now known? So again, the Medrash says that until now, Moshe says, I wondered, what is it that the Jews were doing that more than all the other 70 nations of the world, the Jews have to be enslaved? But now I see that it is appropriate. Again, because of Lashon Hara. So the Rebbe asks, there were people in Egypt who at the time of the Exodus brought with them their idols. So they were guilty of idolatry. And yet, there is nowhere mentioned that because of their sin of idolatry, they are not deserving of redemption. And here Moshe says so simply, so obviously, that if there's Lashon Hara going on, then maybe they're not worthy of redemption. Why is Lashon Hara a greater sin than idolatry? And if for idolatry you don't lose your deservedness of coming out of Mitzrayim, then why for Lashon Hara would you? So briefly, the Rebbe explains it this way. in Lashon Hara, there are many aspects. There's, of course, the sin of Lashon Hara, the fact that it is prohibited, it's an aveza, and if you violate the aveza, then you're violating a commandment. In this, aveda zada is a much more stringent commandment, a much greater violation, because it's one of the three sins for which you have to die rather than commit. So certainly, in its being a sin, aveda zada is a greater sin. Then there's another aspect. There's the aspect of the damage and the effect that a sin has. In Lashon Hara, there is an extremely damaging aspect, in that Lashon Hara damages both the one who speaks Lashon Hara and the one who listens to the Lashon Hara, as well as the person who is being spoken of. So in terms of damage, there's a great damage caused by Lashon Hara, greater than other sins. But for that, that would not deny the Jewish people the right to redemption. There's another aspect of Lashon Hara, and that is simply that Lashon Hara shows that people are not comfortable with each other. The fact that people speak Lashon Hara means that they feel uncomfortable with each other. And it's the discomfort that causes the person to speak negatively about another. Now, when God came to take us out of Mitzrayim, He came to take us out as a people, as a nation. Lokachas loy goy mikerev goy. God came to take a nation out from among another nation. And in order for this to be, we had to behave as a nation. We had to be in the condition of a nation, in the status of a nation. So it's not a question of punishment, that because the Jews were speaking Lashon Hara, therefore they were being punished, or they might be punished, by not being taken out of Egypt. But rather, it was a natural condition, a natural consideration. God wants to take us out as a nation, and we're not a nation. We are not a people. We are fragmented individuals, uncomfortable with each other. So this was why Moshe felt, was frightened, and thought maybe the Jews are not deserving of coming out of Egypt, of being redeemed, not as punishment for the sin of Lashon Hara, but simply because we hadn't yet attained the status of a nation, and God wanted to take us out as a nation. Since this was a preparation, coming out of Egypt was a preparation for the receiving of the Torah, for Matan Torah, which had to be as a nation. So we had to leave Mitzrayim as a nation. And as long as there was Lashon Hara, then we hadn't, in fact, achieved the status of a people and remained a fragmented group. And so the story of the Lashon Hara is appropriate in this particular parsha, because here we're talking about becoming a nation through the Exodus and through the Geula from Mitzrayim. And we need to know that the obstacle towards that kind of redemption is when the people are fragmented and have not and don't behave as a nation.
This concludes the first side of this cassette. Please turn the cassette over and begin again on side 2.